Like so many other things, we can be a little cynical about the places we live. You know, those comments like, it ain't much, but it's mine, or bless this mess, or the other things we say about our homes. There's obviously affection with those comments, too, though. Our homes are important to us. Just having a home is a critical part of who we are as a species. It's a relationship explored in John S. Allen's book, Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. John Allen is a neuroanthropologist and research scientist at the University of Southern California, also part of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Indiana. He's the author of several textbooks and trade books, and he lives in Kentucky. John, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked to neuroscientists and anthropologists here. You're the first combo. What is a neuroanthropologist?
Well, as an anthropologist, a biologically oriented anthropologist, I've always been interested in sort of cross-cultural and universal aspects of how we behave and how we think. And over the last 20 years, when I first started doing this, there weren't these machines that could look into your head and take pictures while you're thinking or just lying there or whatever.
We're talking fMRI?
Yes, the whole neuroimaging world is sort of caught up with anthropology. And so I was working with, and especially at USC, with sort of neuroscientists, and they all like that neuroanthropologist label. So I'll take it on.
It is catchy. Yeah. So the essence of what we're learning here in your book is that we're all basically homebodies in a sense?
We are. Most people are. I think if you look cross-culturally, you see the home, the household, as a really basic unit, and that's kind of looking from the outside. But if you look at it from the inside, from the way people feel and the way people think, we also see that the home is a basic thing. It isn't the same as when viewed from the outside, because the outside of your house reflects your environment, it reflects your social status, it, all these other things. And so that varies tremendously. But I'm interested is that that inside feeling that makes us all feel a bit more comfortable, or that we're in a special place, or a place that we recognize as being ours and not theirs. And so that's my sort of goal to explore that in this book.
Well, you know, as you point out, it certainly helped us biologically to have shelters, but do homes have an effect on us in reverse? I mean, do they help us get bigger brains or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we sort of go back to why would a place like home have done us any good, we see that if we compare what makes us different from our closest ape relatives, that one of the, besides walking around on two legs all the time, which started 6 million years ago or so, well, we see that we have an expanded brain. Our brains are about three times as large as say, a chimpanzee's brain. And that sort of process only happened a couple million years ago, began that. So there was several million years where we were sort of walking around on two legs with basically ape-sized brains, and something triggered this growth of the brain. And when you and just from a physiological standpoint, growing a big brain takes a lot of energy, and growing children with big brains takes a lot of time. And one other thing that we do is we tend to have children overlapping, we're not just one at a time. And so all of a sudden we see that this sort of change has happened where children with big brains more than one at a time are growing, and they have these needs. And partly we started fulfilling those needs by sharing the care with mothers, with parents, with fathers, with other relatives, getting bigger hunks of food that we would then share. The hunks could come in the form of an animal or a large tuber, probably cooking. So all this comes in around 2 million years ago, and all of that favors having a place that you go to repeatedly and you make use of over a longer period of time. And this is different from, say, chimpanzees or gorillas, who might have a broad home range, but they sleep in nests or beds every night, but they sleep in a different place within that home range every night. So they don't really get wedded to a spot.
They don't come back to the same place over and over again.
Yeah, or it's only over a long period of time they might cycle through places.
You give us something else to think about in the introduction to the book, which is it's homesickness and the whole concept of that. And you found it through your own experience with your son that we Americans tend to resist the concept of feeling homesick. Why?
Well, I say that homesickness, I think, is important because it does trigger. It shows that if you've experienced homesickness, you're as some psychologists have said, you're kind of suffering a mini grief over the loss of that relationship. And I think one reason I sort of say today people are uncomfortable with in the American side, and this has been many people have said this, with mourning of any kind. We don't want to deal with that aspect. I mean, it's there. We have to deal with it, but it isn't something we want to dwell on. And so I think even acknowledging homesickness is a thing is almost like acknowledging a mourning, and that's an uncomfortable feeling. And this is in contrast back into the 19th century, where historians have shown that homesickness was actually almost considered a mental illness, and it was called nostalgia.
Really?
America had lots of immigrants, people who were totally divorced from their home, their home countries. They weren't going to email or text back to anybody in 1860. And so they were really missing what was the past for them, and that led to depression and anxiety and other sorts of things. So over time, with upward mobility, we've also embraced geographic mobility and sort of as part of the American dream, in a sense, for some people. And so you're supposed to accept the fact that you might move if you want to move up in society.
Always looking forward and not necessarily looking back.
That's right.
Huh. Interesting to think about that as being paired with the American reluctance to mourn or feel sad about lots of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, home is an important relationship, as if you reflect on it. And if you lose it, it will give you that sense of loss. Now, luckily, as it is with people who, when someone dies, you mourn and you move on. It's okay to be depressed for a while, but you have mechanisms, psychological and support mechanisms, that allow you to succeed again and or not be depressed about it. And I think the same thing is true of home. You can move to a new place, and eventually you will hopefully form a relationship there, relationship with the people there, whatever makes you feel at home, and reestablish home in a new place.
All right. The book is called Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. John S. Allen is its author and our guest. Back on the exchange with him and your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the neuroanthropologist John S. Allen, who works at both USC and the University of Indiana. He's written a book called Home, How Habitat Made Us Human, about the fact that our relationships with our shelters goes beyond what any other creature feels. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about home and our attachment to it. 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you begin the first chapter in Australia and talk about the landscape there, which begs the question, when we talk about feeling at home, John, how narrowly or broadly can we define that? Is it restricted to a house? Can it be, the rolling hills of our youth or something like that?
Oh, I think it can be pretty broad. The Central Australian Aborigines there, who just even to survive have to have an understanding of a vast landscape and how to get the resources out of it, which is quite a sparse landscape, define home in a sort of in that terms of that landscape and less in terms of structures. But for most people, it is the structures. But as the structure identifies what is felt as home, and in the book I kind of say it's almost a perceptual trick, because you feel home, you feel secure, you feel like you're in a safe place, but people live in steel and glass boxes 500 feet off the ground, right? And you mm-hmm. walk in there and you feel, oh, I'm relaxed, I'm great, but if you look, you take one step out, you're going to fall 500 feet. And so in some ways our mind tricks us into thinking that this is the safe place no matter what the structure is. It doesn't really keep us away from huge natural disasters or diseases, but yet it does provide enough protection to let you have a period of rest and restoration. So I think in that sense, the surrounding structure is less important than the feeling you get within it.
You give us a look at emotions in the book. There's a discussion there of the work of a number of people, including Paul Ekman. His work has always fascinated me with the mm-hmm. facial action coding system. FACS. What was it he found about the universality of emotions across all kinds of people on the earth?
Well, he found that people could read faces, would read them similarly across cultures, across quite different cultures, and that was sort of the feel. That was some work he did in New Guinea and in the U.S. and that kind of laid the groundwork for a real revolution in sort of a biological view of emotion and universality. The culture will often obviously shape where those emotions are expressed and how they're expressed, but underlying it is this sort of basic core group of emotions, which is debated how many there are, how you should actually define them, that we're adept at reading in other people and or hiding and expressing in ourselves. And so some of those emotions are big, right? Joy and anger and strong. The emotions that are usually associated with house are something that Antonio Damasio, also does a big lot of research on emotion, has called background emotions. They're much quieter. And a lot of these relate to feelings that have to do with monitoring your own self, homeostasis. And so home is a real place where we go to kind of get our homeostasis, get our bodies back in balance to restore and rest. And we don't necessarily associate these big emotions with that. We have expectations about it. It's only when it's gone or we lose it that we start to get grieving, such as in homesickness.
So this idea of whole being homeostasis takes us another step further. What is that?
Well, I think, you know, you have, your body has these needs that have to be fulfilled. And in the outer world, with all the stimuli you can't control, having to be at least aware and maybe on guard, all these things take a toll. And so home, the place where you rest and you eat, where you connect with the people who are the most likely, whose lives are in sync with your life, which reduces the stress there as well. Home is the place where we go to recharge and therefore, you know, balance that homeostatic sort of thing in your whole body, not just in this little physiology. You know, we have homeostasis is often used in little physiological aspects of the body, but in terms of your whole being, I think home is the place where we can recover.
So feeling at home, I mean, do we know if there's a combination of biology and thought involved here? Are we pretty certain about it, or are we still sort of up in the air about it?
Well, I think feelings are always mind and body. And if you don't want to underestimate the inputs from your body to your feelings, and then on beyond that to your emotions, and even decision-making is strongly informed by emotions, which, again, go back down to body. It's an artificial separation there. And so, to some extent, you know, obviously how that's trained, how that's learned depends on your own personal upbringing. It depends to some extent on your culture. But there's this sort of basic mind-body biological mechanism that's at the core of this. And to some extent, I'm not saying that the feeling of home is hardwired by any means, but the human way of living as a primate who builds things, as a very social animal, as an animal who depends on a family support for many years to even grow up, all that works together to make home a very adaptive place.
John S. Allen's book is called Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. He's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. John, is there a limit to how many places we can feel at home?
Well, I suspect there is. If home, just as anything that is a special thing, the relationships start to diminish, your capacity to have those special relationships may diminish as they increase in number. But I definitely think we can feel at home in more than one place because those sort of psychological mechanisms can be transferred. People can feel at home at their house or feel at home in their workplace as well, as long as they have certain relationships and familiarity and support and so on. That's a kind of a reuse of what wouldn't be, you know, in the more traditional culture, you wouldn't necessarily have home and work separation. But in our world, we do. So, I think you can feel at home in more than one place. I don't know if you can feel at home simultaneously in 50 places. That would probably mean you literally wouldn't be spending enough time in each one to actually develop that sort of relationship.
Mm-hmm. So in the process of this first, we're talking about the first chapter of the book on home. Mm-hmm. How did Dick Cheney, Rob Portman, and Republicans on gay marriage get in here?
Well, I think one of the things that home has as a something it fosters is empathy. And you start to have those you share a household with take on a special, just like the house itself, the place becomes special, just by the fact of proximity, the people you're with also become a special relationship. Now, often, traditionally, you want a more expansive view of who might share a household than what's a typical nuclear family ideal we might have here, but people who share a house could be related, or they could be close friends, ongoing relationship, and I talk about how it's quite clear that sort of grouping fosters this empathy. And I say that I brought up the gay marriage of these conservative Republican politicians, who have gay children often are, you know, don't support the what had been the conservative line of against gay marriage. They were more empathetic. They were with those in their own household. And I look at other mechanisms like that. Living synchronized lives also fosters this sort of positive feelings towards others.
Synchronized lives?
If you're, say, just with a roommate or something.
Oh, okay. So having a life with other people in the house as opposed to just like we show up here and eat and sleep and then we scatter.
Exactly.
Again.
And I think that's something that's sort of implicit in, you say, basic training in the military, right? You get these people from all over the different backgrounds, and you stick them in a same place, and you rigorously enforce them to live on the very same schedule. And what are you fostering? You're fostering a esprit de corps there.
Ah, it's the synchrony you're creating there.
Yes.
Got it. John S. Hallin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the implications of home, what it means to us as individuals, what it means to us as a species. Your calls and comments are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So chapter two in the book gets us into other animal homes. Mm-hmm. We did talk a little bit about simians, apes, making sleeping nests. Some do, some don't. Do we know why?
In terms of sleeping nests?
Yeah.
Well, all the great apes do. All our closest ones, orangs, chimpanzees, gorillas, and presumably our ancestor, because it looks like it might have been something that was shared by the common ancestor of all of us, do make these nests every night. Usually they're in the trees. Some gorillas are so big, big male gorilla, there's no point in trying to make a nest in a tree for them. But so that looks like a common thing. And one interesting study done not too long ago in the zoo was comparing how an orangutan in the zoo sleeps versus some monkeys. And the orang has stuff around, not necessarily branches and stuff, but they give them stuff to make a bed, and it's lying there very comfortably, doesn't wake up as much as the monkey that's sort of sitting on, as they would in the wild, sitting upright. And there's some thought that enhancing sleep does support the physiology of a larger brain, and so maybe that underlies that. So the apes do this sort of thing, and beyond that, other monkeys, other primates, they really aren't builders. They don't live in things. They're kind of out there, you know, on branches and in tree trunks. Now, of course, you know, other animals do live and protect themselves from the environment. They live in burrows and dens and caves. And so, yeah, obviously, you know, that's sort of a convergent sort of thing. But over the last 60 million years of our branch of the evolutionary tree, there really hasn't been much of that. And we're innovators in that context.
Well, let's go up that one alley of sleep just a bit here, because that's a really fascinating one. So it could be that by developing shelters that gave us a place to get essentially a good night's sleep without a whole lot of fear from predators, that we allowed ourselves to become who we are physiologically?
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts with these nests that the apes make, because the apes' brains are also larger in turn than most other monkey brains, except for the great ape brains are substantially larger than you'd see in a monkey. So they already, there's been this sort of jump up in brain size that we see in our closest relatives, and that may, that people say that, you know, enhanced sleep may support that. And then you take that up another level, supporting our very large brain. So whatever we need sleep to do to our brains when we're asleep, and there are lots of different ideas about whether it's a time when toxins are being cleared between the cells and so on, that maybe enhanced sleep was a critical factor. And, you know, anything you protect yourself, any that you get from the environment may enhance that sleep.
There's an interesting comment in here too about climate instability and what that had to do with the emergence of people as people. What?
Yeah.
How did that figure in?
Well, there's a lot of data from Africa that when in this critical time 2 to 3 million years ago, that there was climate instability, and one of the things that we see that made us the successful apes. Apes used to be much more widespread than what we see now. They're kind of a little band that's tropical, except for us. So we're the ape that has adapted and dealt with these fluctuations and then dealt with different sorts of climates all over the old world. And so something in that climate instability may have triggered that and a spread of lots of different versions of apes that walk on two legs, including the version that eventually became us.
So when I think about the differences between us and apes, in particular with the kinds of things that we do, you mentioned that the sleeping spaces that they create. It seems like, though, that for us as humans, we're combining what may have been a bunch of different locations for earlier species into one place. So we've got eating, sleeping, procreating, excreting, which used to be done in a much broader landscape, now essentially under one roof.
Right. I mean, that's quite clear that, you know, as we go back, we look at traditional cultures, people go and bring, you know, even if you go and forage for food outside a living space, you bring it back to a place, and then maybe a place where you might make tools, or especially if you go and hunt and you've killed something that's way more than one person could eat or carry, then you have to cooperatively deal with it, and you bring that back, and that's where all that sort of exchange takes place. Some anthropologists define households as basically a place for energy exchange, energy in the broadest sense of food you might eat or help you might get. And that's a place where all that can happen, and that's clearly been very helpful for us as an evolving species. And so the question then becomes, well, where does that start, right? Which of our ancestors really did this? Was this necessary as soon as we started to get brains that were maybe not three times as large, but twice as large or 50% larger? And that's a big debate, because it's kind of hard to read the archaeological record of 2 million years ago as it sits on the ground.
John Allen's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Glenn Isaac and the home base idea. What did he mean?
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Glenn Isaac in the 70s and 80s did sort of see home base in these terms. And he also would say, this excavation here from East Africa typically shows that there was a home base. Look, someone was doing that here and someone was doing that there. And I think the idea kind of got lost. The basic concept, I think, was fine, but a lot of other archaeologists kind of took them to task for saying, you can't say that deposition of rocks in that corner is due to somebody sitting there flaking stone tools. It's too long ago. It's clearly due to just a stream that walked through. You know, it's a natural deposition or something like that. So it kind of got pushed aside, or at least not accepted. But the basic premise is, I think, quite correct. It had to have happened at some point. And unfortunately, we don't have a Pompeii from 1 million years ago that really shows this. Even cave sites tend to get occupied over and over again, and it, you know, it obscures a single point. And so that's a sort of a problem in this, in that the evidence for an actual house-type structure does not reach back that far, which is why I sort of talk about Neanderthals burying their dead.
Let's get into that fascination in just a moment. We have a question here that actually gets to Neanderthals. Let's go to Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Allen, the author of Home, How Habitat Made Us Human.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, John.
Morning.
First of all, I have a comment and then a question. It's kind of intertying with, I think, what your subject is going to be coming up about. First of all, they say there's a saying that home is where the heart is.
Mm-hmm.
My home is where the bathroom and the kitchen are.
Right.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Now, my question, and I'm serious about this, is do you think that maybe a key thing in evolution as relates to the extinction of the Neanderthals was due to the fact that Homo sapiens or Homo erectus, basically they evicted them from their shelters and they were just left out into the snow and the elements to die? That's my question take on that. And, Jeffrey, I'll take the answer if there is one. Off the radio.
All right. Thank you, Jamie.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. It's the one that's really coming up. It's been there a long time, but it's coming up more and more, is to what extent did modern people, which we think evolved initially in Africa and then went out into the world and encountered less modern people, or people who had been related to them, had separated hundreds of thousands of years before. One thing we now know is that at least in some of the places, Neanderthals and modern people had babies together. But in general, all these pre-modern versions of people seem to have disappeared when modern people got there. So then you start to worry about, people think, well, maybe it was a very aggressive thing, or maybe it's just they were more adapted. Neanderthals were clearly adapted for the cold climates of Europe, and maybe they just weren't as able to compete directly, you know, indirectly or directly. We'll have to see. It's hard to know what could have happened there.
So, so
one
what
thing, Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask about the fascination with Neanderthal burials and what you've learned from those about us and homes.
Yeah, the Neanderthal burial, you know, even from the earliest discovery of them, it appears that they did bury their dead, or at least some of them. Some of them ate their dead. We have those sorts of sites. Clearly, Neanderthal bones processed as though they were deer bones. But other places, you find full skeletons, which is, you know, before that, it's rare in the fossil record. You find full skeletons of very small children, which are, you know, very delicate bones, usually be ripped apart or just, you know, be exposed. So certainly Neanderthal burial looks like a real thing. And some, and so we think, we hear burial, and we immediately, people often neatly jump to this very emotional, symbolic activity, which is would be for us.
Mm-hmm. Hold the thought. We need to get to the break, and we'll come back on the other side of it and finish up the thought about Neanderthal burials with John Allen, the author of Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. Back on The Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John S. Allen, neuroanthropologist working out of the University of Southern California and the University of Indiana. He's written a book that really makes us think about the places we hang our hats, our cribs, so to speak. Home, How Habitat Made Us Human is the book by John Allen. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the significance of how we as a species developed in conjunction with these structures that we've built over the years. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Neanderthals burying people in addition to cannibalizing some of them, it sounds like. What's the significance?
So Neanderthals bury their dead, and some anthropologists have said, oh, it's just corpse disposal, that there's no reason to read any more into it. But burying a big, full male Neanderthal is no small task. It actually takes a lot of planning. It would probably take help. I mean, these are heavy, large individuals, and so it's not something I think you can just sort of write off. But I, as I say in the book, I think corpse burying somebody is about retaining the corpse as well. And many times they're in these sort of cave living sites, which to me shows that there was some care taken to keep them there, probably to keep them where they lived in their life. And so that's a hint to me that there is some sort of place recognition, a relationship of the people who live there and the place that that person may have lived. Now, I'd say that recognition doesn't mean there has to be a symbolic component. Doesn't mean they represented anything other than that. And so to me, it is a hint there that these caves where there are buried dead are actually something home-like to a Neanderthal, which makes sense. Neanderthals are large-brained, capable. Clearly, we're capable of sophisticated behavior. Not quite the technological level as us, although it seems like from the archaeological record, when they ran into modern human technologies, at least some of them were able to take them on. So it's maybe not surprising that there was a feeling for home there, even if we can't find a Neanderthal hut or house anywhere.
Interesting. So having the dead nearby would have made it more of a home, in essence.
That's what I mean, that's my interpretation. I mean, I think it's a more simple interpretation than to think that, as some have argued, that there's some large symbolic component.
How critical, John, do you think fire, the use of fire as in a hearth, appeared to be in the development of the home concept?
Well, it's been always been, you know, in the archaeological record, if you do have actual structures to look at, if you look for one with a fire, that tends to be the one that's identified as a living space, as a home. But as we go back perhaps millions of years, a million or 2 million years, or if we go back to the earlier branches of our tree, they're living on branches. But still, even if they're bipedal, walking on two legs, it seems they probably were using trees still. And the one thing you can't do in a tree is set a fire and make it and cook it.
Right.
So you got to come to the ground for that and spend time on the ground. And so fire, I think, is this sort of step that pushes us out of the trees for once and for all. And also, it becomes that it's also linked into this whole idea of, you know, more energy to support growing brains, to be able to cook tougher meats, large hunks, or to be able to cook big tubers that grow underground that would be otherwise very difficult for us to eat or digest. And so, yeah, I think home is, I mean, and fire is probably an integral part of developing home life.
Well, and then there's an interesting aside here that you you attribute to the folks at CELF, C-E-L-F, at UCLA, mm-hmm. About the modern hearth, what they figured out that is.
The modern hearth is a TV, because it's the orient, when they've looked at households. Of course, this will now change as people get video screens that are personalized,
mm-hmm.
but at least in this era that we're maybe coming to an end, starting in the 1950s, the TV was the organizing thing, as that is, you know, you could often... once you see a room with a TV, you already have an impression of activity patterns in that room because people will be oriented toward the TV.
As opposed to the fireplace in
exactly.
decades past, yeah. Here's a call from Madeline in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Allen.
Hi. What occurs to me is that our attachment to our cell phones, tablets, and laptops possibly is how we keep our homes portable, and maybe because in some ways we feel so insecure in this mm-hmm. society, having these objects is like having our home be more portable and that we bring with us. So we bring it with us everywhere.
Yeah.
Interesting concept, especially when so much can be accessed through the phone. Thanks for the thought, Madeline. Appreciate that. John, what do you make of that?
Oh, I think I actually was talking to some had a previous interview where they asked me about traveling and home and how you feel at home. And I have to say that if you travel and I get, you know, if there's a decent Wi-Fi in whatever cheap hotel I'm staying at, and I look at my phone and I look at these websites that I look at when I'm at home, all of a sudden I feel more at home, right? That instead of, and some people do that, you know, I had a friend who's a big hiker. And he was saying how, you know, he goes on a hike, he's away from the house, and he has his kit. And when he sits down with his kit and he takes out his coffee pot and his little lantern and a few items, all of a sudden this place in the middle of nowhere that he's never been before is more like home. And so I think you can do that electronically as well and maintain those connections, which are triggering something very deep inside you, right? It's not necessarily a conscious thing, but all of a sudden I'm looking at the newspaper or listening to the radio station on the podcast from back home, and I feel more comfortable.
Well, which raises a question that Grumpy John in Grants Pass dropped off. He asks about nomads, such as the Bedouins mm-hmm. or people of the Great Plains, in the sense that you're talking about a concept of home that up till now has seemed fixed, and yet tribes were not fixed, but they still have homes.
That's right. Well, I think to some extent you would probably have... them have this sort of expansive view of home as the whole landscape that they go over. But also a lot of those nomadic groups, they travel with a kit, right, of some mm-hmm. stuff, items, portable housing. You know, it isn't just we're going to walk and we're not going to reestablish life again from and rebuild and remake things from the stuff we find in the next spot, but they already have this. And I suspect that's their home, right, is a more portable version.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, home isn't that you live in an apartment or a mansion or a cell or a yurt or a tent or whatever. You can make those things feel like home because it's defined from within rather than by your surroundings.
We have a question here that goes a little more to the anthropology side, and it's about from James in Arcata. He writes, I spent some time in West Africa and noted the differences in the perceptions of personal space among the folks for whom group living with multiple children from multiple moms is the norm. Question one, are we in the developed world particularly stressed by long hours alone, one-on-one with one infant? Question two is whether you have any insights into the migrant movements currently in the news and how we can address their home needs.
Well, the first is that it's quite possible. I mean, anomie is an isolation and loneliness are, people would say, are hallmarks of a big complex society, is that you could be lonelier in a group of a million than you can be with 100, right? Because mm-hmm. you can be isolated, not have a group. So I think there is probably something to that as we pare down our social groups that we interact with. It's probably the house structure itself is not sufficient. It is partly the relationships you have within them.
Mm-hmm.
As for the migrant issues, and I think that also it relates also to people who are homeless. For economic reasons or for mental illness or for whatever reason, is I hope it makes everyone reflect on what a devastating thing it is to not have a home. That is, when you take your own home for granted, that probably limits your ability to have sympathy for someone who also doesn't have a home. But if you actually reflect on how important home is, not just to your comfort, but to your psychological well-being, to establishing your place within the larger social group, I think you have to recognize that what is going through people, refugees or others who are without home, what a devastating blow that can be.
It's a really profound effect, as you document in a whole chapter about homelessness. And in fact, there's a phrase in it that really caught my eye: physically housed, but cognitively homeless. What does that mean?
Well, I think that can be used in any of the people who are homeless, either maybe as a secondary result of mental illness or addiction. I think also may apply to, say, foster children who grow up in a sort of revolving house situation, that they never have that sort of learning period, that they never learn in a critical time, just like language you have to pick up in a critical period, how to be at home, how to feel at home. And so when you get out of that system and you're on your own, your life is unsettled. And people who age out of foster care systems have very high rates of incarceration and other psychological problems. I'm not saying this is the only cause, but I think that would contribute to it.
Let's take another call here. Steve and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about home with John S. Allen.
Buddy, I came into this late, so I don't know if anybody has mentioned yet that homes are actually a byproduct. They're from when man switched over from being a hunter-gatherer into an agrarian lifestyle, and you had to plant yourself in one place for months at a time waiting for your crops to come in, so you start building more sturdy abodes instead of just lean-tos and tents, and you start settling down in one place because, well, this is fertile. We can do this year after year. They're just a byproduct of, you know, man settling down as opposed to wandering around and gathering food as he can.
Okay, good point. Thanks for that, Steve. John?
Yeah, thoughts? Well, I would actually say it's not home. That's when houses and other structural dwellings became vehicles for all sorts of other things, right? For when we settled down and started building homes, all sorts of, and we became agricultural, all sorts of other, you know, status changes become more profound. And a lot of those are advertised in the structure you live in. But I would arguing that that feeling of home from the inside out, before agriculture, before we had obvious houses, is there in terms of how we define a space that's separate from, that's our own and ostensibly under control, and maybe it really isn't under control, but we feel that way.
But my place
from the wild world.
Mm-hmm. You go through a chapter here on housing booms and busts and things like that, and it raises the question about home ownership itself, which we talk about a bit, as distinct from just having a home. I mean, how modern a phenomenon is this drive to own your own home?
Well, I think it is. It's pretty modern. I mean, in terms of the U.S., it became explicitly in the 1920s sort of a campaign to encourage home ownership. It had been going on before that, but basically home ownership is seen as to make you an active part of the democracy, as a property-owning democracy. Home ownership was encouraged that way, and it's encouraged as a vehicle for savings. And of course, the government policy, we spend the government, although it isn't listed as a cost necessarily, but the tax write-off you get on mortgages is a tremendous government support for home ownership itself. And so what we have then is your house becomes part of the economic system, and in places where there are housing, when prices are going up, when houses seem to be getting more and more expensive almost as you look every week at the prices, then, and houses become investments, I think there is a bit of a conflation there between your feelings for home, which is for security and stability, and how your house is acting out in the economic world. And one line I sort of go into there is, to what extent can this become a confidence amplifier, as economists would say? That is, you may not be able to perceive the risk you're taking in buying a house because it's your home, and your home is there to protect you. And therefore, we often see these stories when people lose their houses due to foreclosure or something. It always seems quite a devastating blow. It isn't just the same thing as going bankrupt. It's like being violated. It's like being betrayed by the thing you live in.
Well, in a sense, it's ultimately then an emotional relationship. I mean, particularly when you think about the ways that we pick houses, you know, it's like, well, okay, the bathroom's a little small and the closets are crap, mm-hmm. but boy, it just feels like home.
Exactly. Oh, it's emotional. That's the key thing to take away. I think these emotions, these feelings of home, they've served us, but, you know, they can also blind us to certain other things in the world around us.
Well, it's a fascinating look at the relationship that we have with our living spaces, and it just goes beyond the four walls and a couch, maybe, and a TV. The book is called Home, How Habitat Made Us Human. It's the work of John S. Allen, neuroanthropologist and research scientist in the University of Southern California and the University of Indiana. John, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.